Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on XM Radio, on RadioPower.org, CRN Digital, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and streaming from AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome to our program. It's the day after Thanksgiving, the day that Kelly Lawson and the folks at Adbusters have declared Buy Nothing Day, Black Friday for our retailers, which I think used to mean a grim day for people who work the counters, but now they've kind of reframed it as the day that companies become profitable. And, of course, the first hour of our program here, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. I think of him as America's congressman. He's currently running for the Senate, in fact, and when he wins it, I'll think of him as America's senator. His website, Bernie.org, www.bernie.org. And Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom, and happy Thanksgiving to all of the listeners.
Well, thank you, Bernie, and I agree with you in that sentiment. We did our program live yesterday, and it was fascinating, all the things that people are thankful for. Iraq is a continuing thorn in our side and theirs.
Well, I think in terms of Iraq, there's some interesting, I think, changes in sentiment that we're seeing in Congress and we're seeing throughout the country. And I think that there is a growing understanding that it is very important that we start bringing home our troops as soon as we possibly can. I think, in my view, I think we should begin significant withdrawals starting after the Iraqi election. My own hope is that we can have many of our troops out in 6 months and hopefully all of them out within a year. And I think one of the things that you're also seeing is that in Iraq itself, Iraqi political leaders are now beginning to make the demand that the president come up with a timetable himself with the withdrawal of American troops. Just a few days ago, there was a political leadership meeting in Iraq, which consisted of leaders from the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds. And they made the request. They made the request that a timetable be established for the withdrawal of American troops. And I think when you're also hearing Iraqi Interior Minister Bayan Jabbar say that American-led forces should be able to leave Iraq by the end of next year, I think there's little doubt that you're going to see more and more members of Congress demanding that we begin to withdraw our troops. And I believe that in the not-too-distant future, and you're really beginning to hear intimations of this from the administration, you're going to hear the president come out with a timetable.
Yeah, we just heard Condi Rice just in the last few days essentially saying the same thing. What I've been suggesting on this program, Bernie, is that the reason why there's been so much rage from the Republicans against Jack Murtha is not that he suggested that we should be getting out of Iraq, but that he said it before they had a chance to say it, that they were planning on, this was their strategy for the 2006 elections anyway, they were just going to use the fig leaf of the December elections in Iraq, and they were waiting for that to roll the thing out.
Well, that could be. But what is very clear now is it will be increasingly difficult for the president to talk about staying there year after year after year when the Iraqi political leadership itself is demanding a timetable for withdrawal. The other thing that I think we have got to focus on is that one of the concerns that many of us have had about the whole war in Iraq, and I, of course, voted against going in there in the first place, is that it deflected attention in a very significant way from the real culprit, the real people who were guilty for 9/11, and that is Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and that group. And I think what many of us understand is that in the last 2.5 years, using our invasion of Iraq as a poster child, you have seen a significant growth in Al-Qaeda chapters in dozens of countries around the world. So to my mind, while we withdraw from Iraq, it means that we also have got to pay increased attention to the reality of international terrorism and Osama bin Laden. And that's just not going to be a military solution. We need to be working with Middle Eastern countries. We need to be working with the UN and the international community to really develop significant ways to combat the very serious danger of Islamic fundamentalism and international terror. So.
Yeah, this being essentially what the King of Jordan, King Abdullah II, had said before we invaded, and he advised against it, what Hosni Mubarak of Egypt said. He said, if you invade Iraq, you'll create 1,000 bin Ladens. Boom.
And that appears, whether it's 1,000, we don't know, but it is certainly a growing problem. And the other point that I want to make, and I hope listeners appreciate this, you know, I come from a state which has paid a very, very heavy price, state of Vermont, for this war. We have lost over 20 men in Iraq, this small state. Others have been injured. A lot of families have seen disruptions in their lives. And all over this country, that is happening, not only with the active duty, but with people, of course, in the National Guard. And what really disturbs me when we talk about Iraq, when the president talks about support of the troops, is the degree to which the Veterans Administration is underfunded by the Bush administration, underfunded by the Republican leadership in Congress, so that today, not only for veterans in general, people who have put their lives on the line, whether it's going all the way back to World War II or Korea or Vietnam or the first Gulf War, they are on waiting lists all over America. They're not getting the care that they need. 150,000 veterans were thrown off of VA care eligibility because they are, quote-unquote, too wealthy because they make $25,000 a year. And now, Tom, what should be of real concern to all Americans is that not only do we have over 2,100 dead in Iraq, we have some 15,000 wounded, half of them seriously wounded. And that's only part of the problem, because what we're seeing now is large numbers of men and women who are coming back from Iraq are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, a very serious problem. And you know what? We don't have the resources now to deal with their problems. And that is in itself an outrage. So what some of us are trying to do in Congress is, instead of giving tax breaks to billionaires and millionaires, coming up with a few billion dollars so that we know when these men and women come back from Iraq or Afghanistan, that they get the care that they need and that they are entitled to. And that is now not the case. So whenever you hear about the president telling us how much he supports the troops, how much he loves the troops, he might want to agree with the take action that the disabled American veterans, the VFW, the American Legion, other veterans groups are demanding of him, and that is adequately fund health care for the VA, which is certainly not the case right now.
Bernie, we just saw, speaking of what the troops are coming home to in the economy, and the whole thing with GM, and I know we talked a little bit about this last week, but we just saw in the last session of Congress, just as Congress was wrapping up, this roughly $54 billion in cuts, as I recall,
yes,
to social programs in the United States, Medicare and whatnot, and veterans programs and whatnot, in order to fund, in part, a $50
billion
cut. $70 billion cut in taxes to the millionaires and billionaires. And looking at the IRS statistics, if you look at the top one-tenth of 1% of Americans, that's the people who earn more than $1.5 million a year, that's only 14,000 families in the entire United States. How do 14,000 families, 14,000 people in this country have so much political power?
All right, 2 points need to be made. Number one, at a time when our healthcare system is disintegrating, it is beyond belief that this president wants to make substantial cuts in Medicaid. When middle-class families can't afford to send their kids to college, he wants to cut back on college loans. When poverty and hunger are increasing in America, this quote-unquote compassionate conservative wants to cut back on school lunch programs, school breakfast programs, and the food stamp program. I mean, this is literally, we're not talking figuratively here, this is taking food out of the mouths of hungry kids in order to give tax breaks to millionaires and billionaires, and that is an absolute national disgrace. So that's number one. Number two, what we're seeing now when you talk about the top one-tenth of 1%, what you should also note, Tom, is that the last study done by the IRS, these were the top 1% were the only group in America that saw an increase in their income compared to inflation in the last study done in 2003. 99% of taxpayers saw a decrease in their real income, and in fact, that 0.1% that you just described earns more income than the bottom 1/3 of American taxpayers, and that's a conservative number because the IRS doesn't do a particularly good job in calculating how much money the very wealthiest people earn.
Absolutely amazing. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. If you'd like to call and speak with Congressman Sanders, our telephone number toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466, 1-866-440-THOM. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Bosses of the world unite, let us save the day.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush.
Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day from Malaysia to Mexico. At that rate, pretty soon, there'll be no place for us to go.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good morning, Tom. Hello, Congressman Sanders.
Good morning, Larry.
Hi. One quick question and then a bit longer one. One is, when you start campaigning for the Senate, will that affect by the election rules whether you can still come on Tom's show on Fridays?
No, I don't think so. This is Tom's show, and if he wants to have me on, I'm going to stay on.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm not flogging, you know, send Bernie money kind of stuff here,
okay.
Although I recommend people do it.
Okay. The second thing
this is not an ad.
Early this morning to the radio, and I heard something that kind of made my jaw hit the table. I heard that somebody down in Washington wants to put extra taxes, fees, or assessments on hybrids and other fuel-efficient cars because they, quote-unquote, won't carry their load for the gasoline taxes for highway construction. Do you know anything about that?
I don't think that's likely to happen. I think most sane human beings know that what we want to do is encourage the use of hybrids in this country and not discourage them.
Yeah. I think, you know, but what Larry is pointing out, this is actually a debate going on out here in the West, Bernie, is let's tax people based on how many miles they drive rather than increasing the tax on gasoline to rebuild our road infrastructure.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense. We could tax workers who are traveling 150 miles to work rather than people who are using gas-guzzling big cars, right?
Well, that's the bottom line. I mean, basically what it is it's a proposal that hurts people who have gas-efficient cars,
right,
and helps people who drive Hummers. And it's actually getting some traction out here, believe it or not.
It is hard to believe, but what can we say?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
I mean, I think clearly, as I've said many times, it is absolutely insane that in America today we are driving cars that get worse mileage per gallon than was the case 20 years ago. The potential is there to give us cars that can drive 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon, and that we're still driving cars that get 15, 10 miles a gallon is unbelievable.
1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Bill, in Waynesboro, North Carolina. You are live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, good morning. And I think I'm touching base on the same subject as the previous caller. The news story is reporting that there's an approximately $1 trillion shortfall in the Federal Highway Trust Fund, and reports that that Congress may have to consider raising the already 18 cents a gallon on the fuel. And my concern is, the last time I did the math, this nation's trucking industry contributes $15 to $20 billion a year into the Federal Highway Trust Fund. The industry is already strapped to the limits with fuel costs, insurance costs, and permit costs, and to raise that would just absolutely destroy us. What that suggests to me is the fund itself is so laden with port barrel projects that it can't sustain the necessary repairs and maintenance that the fund was established for.
Well, I have to tell you that I'm not all that familiar with these news stories that people have been talking about, but what seems clear to me is that at a time when oil prices are soaring, when working people are paying more and more out of their pocket in order to get to work, raising gas prices does not make a heck of a lot of sense. In terms of the transportation bill, we have major infrastructural problems in America. There's no question about that. And in my view, we have to figure out a way that we can adequately rebuild our infrastructure. That's our bridges, that's our roads, that's mass transportation. We have got to do a lot better job than we're doing it now, but you don't raise taxes, regressive taxes, which is what a gas tax is, on working people to do that.
Yeah, good point, Bernie. And what about windfall profits taxes on the oil
companies? That makes a lot more sense to me, and I'm on legislation that, in fact, would do that. In terms of oil prices, what we're concerned about is not only what people are paying at the pump, but what's happening this winter all over America for a lot of seniors, lower-income people who are going to be in a lot of trouble trying to keep their homes warm this winter.
Now, and we just have now Hugo Chavez of Venezuela contributing oil to folks in Massachusetts, some politicians going, hey, this is great. This really highlights, in my mind, the disparity between the control of wealth and oil by a small number of companies here in the United States. And a lot of this oil is actually coming out of, you know, national, you know, like Anwar, they want to take it out of a national park. Isn't that our oil at some level?
Of course it is. If it's on, you know, if it's on publicly owned property, of course it is. And that's a whole other issue.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if we were to raise the royalties that are paid. Well, it's a whole, yeah, we're getting super technical here. We'll come back with your phone calls. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 866-440-THOM. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. Our telephone number, we are live, by the way. It's Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, sometimes referred to as Black Friday. And also on Sunday, maybe a repeat program, but at this moment, if you're listening on Friday, it's a live program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM. And Richard in Charleston, South Carolina, you are live and on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie.org, by the way, is Bernie's website. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Hello, Bernie. God bless both of you guys for doing what you're doing.
Thank you, Richard.
Listen, the truth usually opens up a hornet's nest. And the truth of the things right now in the auto industry is that they're not building what Americans want, which is strange because if you look at what Ford builds for its European customers, they are building cars that get tremendous gas mileage, and they won't even import them into our country. And yet I understand that the president of Ford Motor Company was in Washington this last week with his hand out looking for some sort of tax breaks. And I'm sorry, I think they need do a little bit better job of making what the American consumer wants.
Well, Richard raises a couple of very good points. For a start, over the years, the taxpayers of this country have provided billions of dollars, not just the Ford, but the GM and Chrysler, urging them, in fact, to build more energy-efficient cars. And to my mind, it has been an embarrassment when we find that it's Honda and Toyota who are introducing the hybrids into this country. So that's number one. Number two, what I would add to what Richard said, and I agree with him, But what I would add to him is that the automobile manufacturers in this country are under tremendous pressure from other countries, where products can be made a heck of a lot cheaper with lower wages. And what I worry about very much in terms of the auto industry is not only the car manufacturers, but auto parts. And what you're going to see more and more is those products being made in countries like China, where workers are being paid a buck or a buck 50 an hour. And unless we begin to change our trade policies, I fear very much that you may not have an automobile industry, an auto parts industry, and the other industries that are related to automobile manufacturing in America in this country 10 years from now. And that just ties into a whole collapse of manufacturing in America, the loss of millions of decent-paying jobs, because the bottom line is American workers cannot compete against people who are paid pennies an hour and were then allowed to send their products back into the United States. So this is a huge problem. It has everything to do with the collapse of the middle class, the lowering of wages in America, and the loss of good-paying jobs.
Yeah, we have Delphi replacing $23-an-hour jobs with $9-an-hour jobs.
Tom, this Delphi thing, I mean, the tragedy of losing 30,000 jobs, I mean, that just tells you how fragile the whole automobile industry is. General Motors is in very serious trouble, as are the other American manufacturers. What Delphi is about is converting the American middle class into low-income workers, slashing wages by 50 or 60%. And you have a guy from the American Manufacturers Association, and these are the people who have been extolling all of these free trade agreements. His name is Jerry Jasinowski, and this is what he says, and I quote. This is from the National Association of Manufacturers. And this is what he says, and every worker in America should listen to what he says, and I quote, from airline pilots to auto assembly workers, employees need to help reduce their costs. We can't afford to live with the very generous benefits we provided 10, 15 years ago, end of quote. Jerry Jasinowski, the Manufacturing Institute at the National Association of Manufacturers. So what these guys are saying, what that is translated into English is, we are going to lower your wages, lower your benefits. What happened in Delphi can be happening across the board to all American workers. If you're in the middle class, if you're earning a decent wage, decent benefits now, be prepared to see savage cuts. So there's a war going on against working people in this country, and we have got to fight back, or we're really in serious trouble.
And one of the major tools that's used in that war are our trade policies.
Yeah, and these are the guys. The National Association of Manufacturers led the effort for permanent normal trade relations with China, for NAFTA, for all of these terrible trade agreements. And then they say, see, now we have globalization. We're going to have to lower your wages. We can't compete.
Yeah.
And that's
By the way, just in small defense of the auto industry, Bernie, in some small way, just an anecdote, I'd love to get your take on this. When Louise and I first moved to Vermont 10 years ago, we had bought a house in Northfield that was had a half mile long dirt road driveway that went up the side of a mountain, and we needed to get a four-wheel drive vehicle. And we had a small business, and it had a profit in it. And my CPA said, buy a car that weighs more than 6,000 pounds. Because if you buy a car that weighs more than 6,000 pounds, you can take a $17,000 tax deduction, whereas if you buy a car that weighs 5,900 pounds or 2,000 pounds, like a typical car, you can only depreciate $2,000 a year, more or less.
Right.
And so,
tax policy which encourages...
Right. We went out and bought a Land Rover, which we had for a couple of years, and it was nuts. It got 7 miles to the gallon. I finally traded it in on a Honda Insight after we moved into Montpelier. And thank goodness, and that was the same year, by the way, that Congress gave $1 billion to GM, Ford, and Chrysler to develop hybrid technology, and I had bought a hybrid car that year.
That's right. So, I mean, I think your point is well taken. We need tax policy. We need tax credits. We need to encourage these manufacturers to produce energy-efficient cars. The technology is there, and let's start doing it.
Yeah, because that $17,000 tax break on vehicles over 6,000 pounds has now become a $100,000 tax break. I remember we walked into the dealership, and the guy said, by the way, our cars weigh 6,010 pounds. He says, we're getting a lot of people... Yeah, he said we're getting a lot of people who own small businesses in here, and they're looking for Land Rovers or Chevy Suburbans or whatever. You know, they all weigh exactly 10 or 15 pounds over 6,000 just to qualify for that tax break. Anyhow, let's go back to the phone lines. 1-866-440-8466. 866-440-THOM. Dennis in Louisville, Kentucky. You're live and on the air with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen, and happy Thanksgiving to you all. My whole thing is, what I'm, you know, this guy, Bernie just kind of stole my thunder a little bit there. I was going to point out, I went shopping this morning at 4 o'clock this morning to buy some gifts and stuff, and nothing was manufactured here in the United States. And, you know, Bernie's kind of hit on it already, but I want to hit it part of the problem, too, which is, I think, callers like Richard that say, we don't make anything you want in America anymore. And, you know, who do you think America is? Who do you think that you're going to punish by not buying American products? It's going to be the Americans. We have a self-hatred type of deal going on. It's the same thing in the black community. Blacks don't do business with themselves. And, you know, I find more often I'm doing more business with whites. You know, blacks, you know, they know I'm in business, but they sometimes pass on me to go deal with a white person, but I've got loyal customers of the other race. I think that's the same problem in the United States. We think because it's got import on it, it's better somehow. And, you know, maybe the gas mileage is better, but I think we're killing ourselves by not supporting ourselves, and we've got to take it a step. We're feeding into the corporations that want to cut our jobs and stuff, and people don't understand it. You know, I don't get it. When my neighbor doesn't have a job, that means I can't do business with him. And, you know, eventually my business is going to be hurt. So I don't understand why we say it with such, you know, dignity that, you know, well, you know, they're not producing anything that we want. So therefore.
Well, yeah. Let me just take a little bit different spin on this, Dennis. I think what happened 30, 40 years ago, corporate America made a decision. And they said, look, why should we build furniture? Why should we make clothing? Why should we produce steel? And on it goes in the United States. Pay people a living wage, provide health care, protect, have to obey environmental regulations. Why should we do all these things when we can go to desperately poor countries? People are delighted to work for pennies an hour. No environmental regulations. If you do business in China, people try to form an independent union, they go to jail. That's a good place to do business. Let's do that. And out of that came a whole set of trade agreements, NAFTA being one of the prominent ones, permanent normal trade relations with China, which essentially are literally encouraging companies to throw American workers out on the street, go abroad, produce products there, and then bring them back into this country tariff-free.
I agree with you 100%, Congressman Bernie. And by the way, I am supporting you as senator. I am sending money. But also, too, you know, it's got to go back with us.
Yes, you're right. No argument, Dennis. We have got to demand that products are manufactured in the United States, good products that we can buy. No argument about that.
Well said, Dennis. Thank you very much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Gary in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Morning, Tom. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. And
your guest.
And the same to you.
Thank you.
We have 1 minute left here.
I'm sorry. Thank you. What I've always wondered are why, if General Motors is making a good product, which I believe they've come a long way, why, I know they're in a lot of financial problems, but why can't they up their warranty? Americans like guarantees, and I think if Hyundai's 10 years, 100,000 miles, if they would up it to just 5 years, 50,000 or 7 years, I think a lot of people would come to their side and buy their cars more. I know it's a cost factor. I like your comment. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Gary.
I don't have any, you know, profound thoughts on that. I think it makes sense, but, you know, General Motors presumably knows their business. But I think the idea of extended warranties, knowing that when things break down, you're going to get it repaired, makes sense to me. But,
I wonder, Bernie, to what extent there's this whole business of let us sell you an additional warranty at the dealership, you know, for an extra $600, $700, $800, and it's like a profit. It's become a profit center, and I'm wondering if the American auto manufacturers are addicted to that, you know. But I don't know.
I don't know either.
Yeah. Okay. So something we'll have to look into. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number 866-440-8466. We'll be back with your calls right after this. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I know it's my duty to spend and to buy, to prove to Bin Laden I'll shop till I die. I'm a world-class consumer, I'm sure of my role. I vote with my dollars for corporate control. I'll prove.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org. Bernie.org, his website, is with us. Paul in Olympia, Washington, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I enjoy your discourse. I'm a music teacher in this area, and I travel from school to school teaching instruments. And on Kennedy's assassination day, I had asked my kids, you know, what was the significance of the day, and hardly any of them knew. And it really touched me that, you know, maybe we're funding so much in testing that we're not really funding the teaching anymore. It seems like kids don't know their history.
Well, Paul, you raise a very important issue, and it's not just, you know, Kennedy's assassination. It is kids don't know when the Vietnam War was fought. They don't know what World War II was about. They know very little about our Constitution. And I think that there is a general consensus that we do not do a good job about educating kids about our history, about the role of government in our society. And we have got to do much, much better if we are serious about maintaining a real democracy, because you can't make good choices politically if you don't have a sense of history, if you don't have a sense of what our country is about. So I think you raise a very important point, Paul.
Thank you, Paul. 1-866-440-THOM. Ralph in Kansas City, Kansas. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Ralph?
Yeah, hello?
Hey, Ralph. You're live and on the air.
Yeah, I listen to you all the time. I really appreciate you. So I wanted you to know, I think you did a good job. I farmed back in the 80s. I'm still involved in farming. I truck. And the thing I noticed is everybody don't want to really talk about our money system in this country, and about how the monies have actually went in, and they've, they've just cut everybody's throats. And what I understand is I explain it exactly, is
Yes, Ralph?
Well, what I'm saying is, you know, they just print the money up and issue it out when they want to. I mean, there's no control over the currency.
Yeah.
Well, if I loan all of you $20 apiece and loan Bernie $20 to run the infrastructure and said, now pay me the interest, somebody's going to end up short, aren't they?
Well, what we have, Ralph, is, I don't know if this is where you're coming from, but we have a huge national debt, which is some $8 trillion, which equates to about $28,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. And one of the things that disturbs me very much is that instead of seriously tackling this national debt, we have a White House which is continuing to give huge tax breaks to people who don't need it, which is and spending a lot of money in areas that we should not be spending money, and that is a very sad legacy to leave to our kids.
This is the Reagan starve the beast strategy, isn't it, Bernie? I mean, this
well,
is the
well
beast
be.
Being social services funding.
Yeah, you cut back. Yeah, you give huge tax breaks and you spend money on areas that we shouldn't be spending. And then one day you wake up and you announce we have this huge debt. We have to privatize Social Security, Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut veterans programs, and so forth. So, yeah, I think it's part of that syndrome.
Seth in St. Paul, Minnesota. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Seth, you're breaking up really badly. I'm sorry. You'll have to give us a call back. Bill in Salt Lake City, Utah. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Tom, Bernie, great. I've got 2 points really quick. They're both about the auto industry. The first one is that a few months ago I was watching a PBS special about the first gas crisis in the country. And back in 1978, Volvo Wagon, they designed a car that got 68 miles to the gallon. And it's not an urban myth or a legend, because the three cars that they built as prototypes are still in existence and being driven by the engineers that built them. And, you know, this is 25-year-old technology that, you know, is actually better gas mileage than the new hybrids we have. And then my second point is my spouse works for a company that builds and puts in the airbags for General Motors. They're the biggest client they have. And GM's been pressuring them for the last year to move their production overseas. So either way they went, whether they whether GM forced their vendors to move overseas or whether GM closes their plants, they're still cutting American jobs. So I have absolutely no sympathy for GM, and they really don't need a tax credit. They just need to pull their heads out and keep the jobs in America and, you know, do a better job of managing their own yard.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, Bill makes a couple of interesting points. The last point is GM urging their supplier to move to China, to Asia. This is a very scary scenario, and what we are looking at now, there is some evidence that within the next couple of years, for the first time, Chinese-made cars are going to be coming into the American market, and how long American manufacturers can stay in business competing against that remains to be
seen. Well, isn't GM making engine blocks in China right now?
Yeah, they are. They are making products in China, I think it's GM, to be sold in China. They're not bringing them back to the United States right now. But we believe that in the not-too-distant future, that may, in fact, happen. And the second point about efficient cars, Bill is absolutely right. The technology is there. And we can do it, and it is just a national disgrace that we're not moving in that direction.
Yeah, and this is something where we, the people, political will could be brought to bear.
Right.
Yeah, well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website. Check it out. Bernie Sanders, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. Hopefully soon to be the only independent member of the Senate. Well, yeah, replacing Jim Jeffords, still the only independent member of the Senate. Bernie, thanks so much for being
with
us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
As always, have a great weekend.
Bye-bye.
And it is Black Friday. It's Buy Nothing Day with the folks at AdBusters.org. Tomorrow is Buy Local Day, which, frankly, I think is even a better idea. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. The website, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there. And drop in to our live chat room if you'd like. Just click the link to the live chat room, or you can drop into our message area and blog and post your thoughts for all of posterity. There's some, I don't know, 90,000 messages in there. It's pretty amazing when you get right down to it. I want to talk about money. Today is, it's Black Friday, as it were. Here we are right after Thanksgiving. It's the hysterical weekend shopping explosion, Lollapalooza, whatever you want to call it. And you know, money is a big issue in America, and it's becoming a bigger issue as the American middle class is being turned into the class of the American working poor. More and more people, more and more Americans are falling out of the middle class and into the working poor. And I find it particularly interesting that yesterday in the New York Times, Robert Frank, who used to hang out with Ben Bernanke. Ben Bernanke, by the way, is the guy who's going to replace Alan Greenspan as the head of the Fed, or who, for all practical purposes, well, he hasn't taken the seat yet, so he will. And no doubt about it, you know, it's going to happen. And he and Robert Frank co-authored a book called Principles of Microeconomics. And Robert Frank just, you know, wrote this op-ed piece in the New York Times. He says, sometimes a tax cut for the wealthy can hurt the wealthy. And he goes into this whole thing about how the essential insanity, the essential core stupidity of the right-wing tax, the whole right-wing tax policy that Grover Norquist and, you know, it really started with Ronald Reagan and has been pursued with the exception of the Clinton administration. We're just talking about tax policy here, not trade policy. with the tax policies that, with the exception of the Clinton administration, has basically held for the last 20 years, 25 years. And he suggests that this isn't good for wealthy people either. Yes, there are 14,000 families in America who make more than $1.5 million a year. They're the top one-tenth of 1% of wage earners in the United States, as it were. And those 14,000 families have made out like bandits under the Bush administration, with the Bush administration tax cuts. I mean, literally billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars have been transferred to these 14,000 families by the Bush administration. And they've been very generous in saying, thank you very much. You know, here, Republicans have some money. But as Robert Frank points out, again, the co-author with Ben Bernanke, the new head of the Fed, points out in this op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times, this may not be a good thing for rich people either. And this is the point I keep making. I remember the first time I went to India, and this back, it must have been about 1980 or thereabouts, and in Bombay, we were staying in this hotel right down on the bay, and it's just a beautiful place and all that kind of stuff, and relatively cheap, actually, because the dollar was so strong at that time. And you walk out the front door, and boom, you're surrounded by a crowd of little kids, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, and, you know, with in some cases, leprosy, in some cases, missing fingers, you know, snot nose, flies around. A lot of them really covered, you know, raggedy, and some of them, of course, intentionally looking as bad as they can so that they're more effective beggars. And they all have their hand, although a lot of them just so profoundly poor, and they all have their hand out and they're asking for something. And you walk down the street and they follow you wherever you go. I remember driving into Bombay the first time I got there. It was at night. I came in on a night flight, got there around midnight. Driving into town, mile after mile after mile, looking at the sidewalks, it looked like cordwood stacked on the sidewalks. It was people sleeping on the sidewalks. By the mile, just, you know, one after another, you know, just to the point, not you know, horizontally the length of the sidewalk, but vertically or perpendicular to the sidewalk, so there would be more, you know, more people could fit onto the sidewalk. I took a train across India from Bombay to Hyderabad, and then from Hyderabad to Rajahmundry. This is literally all the way across the continent. Everywhere you stop, there are shacks and shanty towns around the railroad tracks, people using the railroad tracks as basically a giant toilet. And there are very rich people in India. Is this the kind of world that we want? Is this the kind of society that we want to have in the United States? That's the kind of society that you have when you have, you know, a lot of wealth and a lot of poverty. And the wealth is concentrated in a very small number of hands. And this is the point that Robert Frank makes in this article in yesterday's New York Times, this op-ed piece called Sometimes a Tax Cut for the Wealthy Can Hurt the Wealthy. And the point that he makes, you know, he says on the benefits side, yeah, the wealthy people have been able to buy larger homes. They got more money. They have actually a lot more money. The top 1% of Americans made out really well since George Bush came into office. The other 99% of Americans have actually lost income since George Bush came into office. And that top 1% thinks that they can insulate themselves from the social damage that's being done by these tax cuts by living in gated communities, by packing their kids off to private schools, and all that sort of thing. And to some extent, they can insulate themselves. But there are a lot of things that the very wealthy among us can't insulate themselves from. And that's that reality that I came face to face with in India. And that's the direction, frankly, that this country is going if we continue using Reaganomics and Bushonomics. These insane, you know, Grover Norquist tax policies. Because what happens is when you start slashing away at the social safety net and you start making it impossible for people to be socially mobile, economically mobile, that is, they can't move out of from generation to generation to generation, they can't move out of terrible poverty into the middle class, in part because jobs for the middle class are not available, in part because education and higher education are not freely available, because they would have to be freely available for people to move out of poverty into the middle class. What you have is a highly rigidified society. Now, India has had a highly rigidified society for centuries, for millennia, for thousands of years. I mean, it's literally, they call it a caste system. You know, from the Brahmins at the top to the untouchables at the bottom, there's been this caste system, and there's still, you know, still echoes of it. That's what's coming back here. And the point that Frank makes in this piece He says, even though the wealthy have been able to buy larger homes, that doesn't necessarily mean that they've gotten happier. All the studies on happiness show that the amount of stuff you have after your basic survival needs are met, food, shelter, transportation, family, you know, safety, the bottom of Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, once those are met, once those basic needs are met, getting more stuff tends not to make people happier. In fact, a lot of the really fascinating psychological studies that have been done on people of great wealth finds that very often they're the most miserable and neurotic among us. So anyhow, the wealthy have gotten wealthier. But Frank points out, deficits, these giant deficits that have been generated as a result of these so-called tax cuts for the wealthy, I say so-called because really what they are is we're borrowing the money from our children and grandchildren and giving it to today's wealthy people. Because the money is being borrowed, and it's being borrowed largely from China, Korea, South Korea, and Japan, although a lot of it's being borrowed from Saudi Arabia as well and other countries around the world. These deficits, he says, have led to cuts in federal financing for basic scientific research. Such cuts threaten the very basis of our long-term economic prosperity. That's going to hurt the rich, he says. Large deficits, he points out, also threaten our public health. I remember the last time I was in India, which was probably, I don't know, about 10, 12 years ago, I was flying to Hyderabad, and there was the Indian business paper. I forget the name of it, but a magazine. There's a magazine that's the Indian equivalent of Business Week. There was an article in there about how over 200 million people in India are infected with tuberculosis. Now, you know, that's like a fifth of the population. And there was, you know, some guesses it may be as many as 300 million, a third of the population. That's about as many people as there are in the entire United States. And I remember, you know, in the Hyderabad airport, seeing some guy who was leaning over a a trash can in the lobby in the waiting area there for a flight, just blowing his lungs out into this thing. And everybody backed away from him. There's like a 15-foot circle around him. Nobody wanted to get close to this guy because everybody figured, okay, he's one of the ones who has TB. Well, the spread of microorganisms, you know, it's going to hit rich people as well as poor people. Our highways and streets falling apart. You know, we're not doing the maintenance. And, you know, he points out that if you do repairs on roads that have not been maintained, it costs 2 to 5 times as much as if you simply maintain them. And he points out that, you know, a Ford Escort that loses a wheel and a tire because of a pothole costs $63, but a Porsche 911 costs $1,569. You know, the rich people get hit by it just like poor people do. And, of course, our national security, the possibility of a dirty bomb, for example, going off. The Bush administration cutting funding to help secure nuclear loose nukes floating around in the former Soviet states so that they can have tax breaks for the wealthy. And the wealthy think, oh, this is cool, we'll take the tax breaks, not realizing that if that nuclear material shows up in their neighborhood, it could be a bad thing. So tax cuts for the wealthy hurting the wealthy. But how do you construct a tax policy that works? And what was Franklin Roosevelt talking about when he talked about the Economic Bill of Rights? I'm going to get into that right after this break. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harbin here, where being progressive never felt so good.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, hey, there's a new American way. No one's serving those deserving, but there's less tax to pay. We abuse our might and mock the world as we say. Don't mess with the U.S. of A.
And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Can you imagine if a president of the United States the first or second week of January, got up to give the State of the Union address. There's going to be one coming down the road here in another, 6 weeks or so from George W. Can you imagine if the President of the United States got up for the State of the Union address, speaking to all the people of the United States as well as all the people of the world, and said something like this? It is our duty now to begin to lay the plans and determine the strategy for the winning of a lasting peace and the establishment of an American standard of living higher than ever before known. We cannot be content No matter how high that general standard of living may be, if some fraction of our people, whether it be one-third or one-fifth or even one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, and insecure. This republic had its beginning and grew to its present strength under the protection of certain inalienable rights, among them the right to free speech, free press, free worship, trial by jury, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. They were our rights to life and liberty. As our nation has grown in size and stature, however, as our industrial economy expanded, these political rights proved inadequate to assure us equality in the pursuit of happiness. We've come to a clear realization of the fact that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men, hungry men, are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station, race, or creed. Among these, in this new economic bill of rights, are the right to a useful and well-paid job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of this nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every business person, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies, either at home or abroad. The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All of these rights spell security. We must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being, America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. Can you imagine if a president of the United States got up and said that? Franklin Roosevelt delivered that address on January 11th, 1944, as his State of the Union address. No matter how high the general standard of living may be, if some fraction of our people, whether it's one-third, one-fifth, one-tenth, is ill-fed, ill-clothed, or ill-housed and insecure, we are not free. And now we know. You look at the 2004 statistics, and this is from the federal government, by the way. These are federal statistics. 11.9% of all households in America experience food insecurity. That means they literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from. This has exploded since 1999. Absolutely exploded. In 1999, it reached a historic low. Households with children, 17.6%. Households with children under 6, 18.5%. Households with single mother families, 33% experience food insecurity in the United States. I mean, this is mind-boggling. Households with income under 100% of poverty, these are people who are working, 36.8% of people who are making under 100% of poverty. People are making 100 to 130% of poverty. This is like $13,000, $14,000 a year. 26.7% of them experience food insecurity. The state with the worst food insecurity in the year 2002 through 2004, the last years for which there are federal statistics available, Texas, 16.4%. 16.4%. In the Northeast overall, 9.7%. In the Midwest, 10.9%. In the South, 13.3%. In the West, 12.8%. Franklin Roosevelt was fond of quoting, he said, an old judge. I'm not sure who the judge was, but he said, an old judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. A hungry person is not a free person. We have to take care of our basic core economic needs. What might those be, and how do we do that? We'll talk about that right after this break. We'll take your calls on the topic, too. If you have some input for this, or if you'd like to offer a different perspective, feel free to. You know, if you find a hole in my logic, take me on. 1-866-440-THOM. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's a place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Truth and common sense in broadcasting. The Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. You know, it's there are basically two kinds of economies. The historic human economy, and the one that is still acted out by a significant percentage of human beings on this planet, people who live in what we might call indigenous societies or tribal societies, is that what you do all day long is you make security for everybody around you, as well as yourself. In other words, you find food, you make shelter, you increase the quality of the social world in which you live, the social general social capital. You tell stories that transmit culture. From elder to younger, from generation to generation, that sort of thing. And so what you do all day long is you make security, you make safety, you make happiness. And what you consume from that society is safety, security, and happiness. And then there's the economies of what we call the modern world. And there are some societies where there's still a good chunk of what I just described. In the what the conservatives in America would refer to as socialist countries like Sweden, where actually they're actually full-blown democracies where democratically the people have gotten together and said, you know, we just want to make sure that everybody has health care, everybody has a decent minimum wage, everybody has the right to union representation, everybody has a safety and security in their old age. Everybody has, you know, there is this basic... The bottom end of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where Abraham Maslow said that people will not attend to things like self-actualization and friendship and loving relationships and all that. They can't even get to those things until they've taken care of basic needs of safety and security and, you know, dealt with hunger and shelter and that kind of stuff. That we're going to make sure that those issues, for the rest of your life, you don't have to worry about that stuff. And there are those who suggest that, you know, for example, after the plagues in Europe in the 14th century, it led to the Enlightenment to the Renaissance as a direct consequence of that, because there were fewer people, there were more resources, and people had leisure time. But I digress. Anyhow, so what we have is we have a cycle where instead of making security all day long, what we do is we make stuff all day long, goods or services, and then we try to acquire security, safety, and happiness by consuming stuff. So we consume stuff to try to acquire safety, security, and happiness, and then we make stuff, and we get caught in this, you know, it's like a hamster on a wheel. And some among us get enough stuff that they actually have lifelong safety, security, and the ability to then step up the ladder into happiness. In other words, they never have to worry about getting sick. They never have to worry about getting old because they've got, you know, a couple million bucks in the bank or whatever. But it's a very, very small number of people in this society. And everybody else, well, we all live in the world that Alan Greenspan described back in 1999 when he told the Wall Street Journal that he felt that part of his job as chairman of the Fed was to maintain a certain level of worker insecurity so there wouldn't be pressure for what he called wage inflation. Well, what Franklin Roosevelt was talking about in his State of the Union address in 1944 is what I'm talking about right now, which is saying, let's go back to that vision of America. That the conservatives and Republicans started dismantling when Ronald Reagan came into office. And let's rebuild this country. Let's rebuild our internal infrastructure. Let's rebuild our social capital. Let's go back to rational trade policies, and let's go back to rational taxation and economic policies so that we can, you know, once again be at least moving in the direction of being a society where, in part, what we do all day long, in addition to making goods or services, in addition to making stuff, we're making security for not only ourselves but everybody around us. We're back to being a society rather than a bunch of, you know, lonely libertarians out there looking out for ourselves and thinking that somehow this virtue of individual selfishness is going to translate into a society that works. It never has. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. David in Bainbridge Island, Washington. David, you're live and on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted a reference to what you're talking about today. Ronald Reagan came into power in 1980, and the first thing they did was cut taxes on the wealthiest Americans. During the 8 years of the Reagan administration, the United States borrowed more money than any president since the beginning of our country.
Actually, that's if I may interrupt George you, David, Washington. if I may interrupt you, the actual number is that during the 8 years of the Reagan administration, Ronald Reagan borrowed more money than everybody from George Washington
yes.
to Jimmy
all
Carter combined. Combined.
Combined.
He borrowed
right.
more money in 8 years.
Including two World Wars.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right.
No, combined. And since then, George Bush Jr. in his 5 years has even borrowed more than Reagan did.
Right. He's borrowed more than Reagan and every other president
yes.
combined. I mean, you know,
and,
we had our...
Again,
yeah.
he had a tax cut on the wealthy. One-tenth of 1% of the wealthiest got 10% of the tax cut, and the top 10% in this country got 60% of the tax cut. And there was an article in the Seattle Times the other day showing 60% of corporations in this country do not pay income tax.
Right.
And this,
by the way, David, we shouldn't call this a tax cut because it's not. These people are paying fewer taxes, but those taxes are going to have to be paid eventually, and they're going to be paid by
right.
our children and grandchildren.
Right.
This is really a tax deferral.
Yeah.
This is shifting tax from today's wealthy
yeah.
to tomorrow's working class.
But the fact is that if he put the taxes back up, Bill Clinton came in and he raised the taxes on the wealthy, and everyone screamed doom and gloom that we're ruining the economy.
Not one Republican voted for them.
Our deficit was gone.
Yeah.
And we had a surplus and a booming economy. But as soon as George Bush Jr. came in, he cut the taxes on the wealthy, and our deficit spending started again.
Yeah, there you go. You're absolutely right and well said. And it has spun out of control ever since. And when Bill Clinton proposed, by the way, that very modest tax increase on largely the wealthiest in America, keep in mind the number of families in the United States that earn more than $1.5 million a year, the wealthiest one, it'd be 0.01, it'd be wealthiest 1/100 of 1% of Americans, is 14,000 families. When Bill Clinton increased the taxes on them, and people in actually, you know, in let's say the top 5-10%, it was a relatively small tax increase, but it gave us incredible prosperity and a balanced budget. George Bush comes in and slashes that tax cut, those taxes, and now, boom, where are we? We have gone from being the richest nation in the world, the nation that more countries owe money to than ever before in history, to becoming the poorest country in the world. We owe more money to other countries than ever before in history. Karen in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom?
Yes, you are live and on the air.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to comment. We were talking about Robert Frank's column, and then you went into India. And I was going to say one of the problems with India is they have a very hierarchical, I don't know how to pronounce it, society. And it goes, I'm a rabid feminist, by the way, so I'm always saying, well, if those people espoused feminism and equality between the sexes, they wouldn't have created all those levels of value for human beings, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then,
I don't disagree, although women who are in the Brahmin caste versus women who are in the untouchable caste are separated by an ocean in India,
no,
in Indian society.
And then you went on to mention Sweden as, you know, a place of, I guess they're doing pretty well economically. And Scandinavian countries have a history of being very egalitarian as
yes.
far as the sexes go.
At least in the last few hundred years.
Let us
not forget the Viking invaders
actually,
of England.
I have to disagree with you because I'm a Swede.
Well, I'm a Norwegian, so my father's, both his parents came over here from Norway in the 1917. So.
Okay. Well, my argument is, the Vikings were very egalitarian in regard to women, and when Christianity came in and polluted the society, that egalitarian was lost.
Oh, that's interesting. It would be interesting to know the real history, Karen, because
okay.
I've traveled around. And thank you for the call. I've traveled around Ireland and England, and people talk. In Ireland in particular, you can find the old castles along the seacoast where they built the castles to keep out the Viking invaders. You know, who came and not only stole their riches but also stole their women in many cases. Anyhow, our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. And Ed in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Yes, good afternoon to you. You were going over the list of rights that Franklin Roosevelt wanted Americans to have, and including every American having a right to a decent home. And and that was said in 1944, as you mentioned. In 2005, I can't imagine how you can make that a reality. I know how he was able to...
You just go back to what Roosevelt had. You go back to the conditions that he put into place. We do away with all of these phony baloney trade policies, and we go back to a tariff-based trade policy where we decide what industries we want to have in America and which ones we don't, and we protect the ones we want to have, and we don't the ones that we don't, number one. Number two, you go back to a taxation policy where we say, hey, you know, if you want to make $1 million a year, great. You know, that's fine. You want to make $20 million a year, that's cool. But you're going to have to pay a higher tax on the next $19 million. You want to make $1 billion a year, that's fine. But you're going to pay a really higher tax on the next, you know, $900 million. And you know, just go back to that kind of a system that somewhat levels things out, and you will have the world that we were moving in the direction of. I mean, restore the social safety net, Ed. I don't think it's going to be that hard, frankly. It's just going to take a political consensus across the board. Thanks for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got to go back. We got to go back.
See, that's what I'm talking about.
Got to go back.
We've done it before in this country.
Got to go back.
We built the biggest and most powerful industrial machine in the history of the world. We had a wealthy nation. We had a social safety net. I mean, we weren't all the way there. LBJ came along with the Great Society program in 4 years, cut poverty in half in the United States. And by giving people who traditionally had not even had bootstraps to pull themselves up by, produced an entire generation of folks who moved out of poverty and in solidly into the middle class. Folks like, you know, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, who had been, you know, just two generations before had been, their families had been victims of legal apartheid in the United States. We can go back. We can do it. But we have to change the rules of the game. I mean, it's just very simple. You've got to change the rules of the game. You can't criticize. I just don't think it's appropriate to sit around and say, well, you know, it's that terrible Walmart or it's that terrible, you know, whatever, when in fact it's the rules of the game that allow it to happen. Bobby in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're live and on the air. Hey, Bobby.
Thank you for taking my call and giving me the opportunity to ask you this question.
Sure.
I love having you in Pittsburgh. I was glad when WPTT picked you up.
Thank you.
But
me too.
I have a question.
Sure.
You were talking about your Prius, your Honda, your Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
And I'm a person who, you know, I came from a steelworker family, as many of us do here in Western Pennsylvania. My father would never, ever consider driving anything but an American car, nor would I. You know, I've had my first car was a Vega, a standard shift Vega, great little car for me. I know that some of them were bad. Mine was great. You know, my daughter has a Prism. She drove up in the snow on Wednesday night. We had snow here. One of her friends tried to come to our house, and we're kind of on a hill, and they were in Honda, and someone had pushed them. And I'm just wondering your position as far as the Prius, the Honda, the Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had Prisms, I've had Vegas, I've had Chevettes, I've had Geos, all of which have good gas mileage, all of which have been great cars for me, very little repairs. I'm wondering your position.
I've owned several good American-made cars in my lifetime. Right at the moment, I don't own an American-made car in a way. The fourth largest manufacturer of cars in the United States is Toyota. And although the Toyota Prius is not made in the United States, they will be in a year or so because they're starting to make hybrids here. So you could argue, you know, the Toyota is an American-made car. But really the issue is much larger than that, Bobby. I'm sure that there are things in your house that are not made in the United States.
Well, there weren't until I couldn't. I mean, we know we bought Zenith TVs from the local TV dealer as long as we could, and we paid a little more.
Right.
I don't go into Walmart. We bought Maytags from the local Maytag dealer as long as we could. We buy everything that we can. I mean, we practice what we preach.
Right,
you know?
And you can't anymore.
And honestly, we've talked other friends into trying American cars. I mean, we've had friends who were driving Volvos, Land Cruisers, as a matter of fact, and they've switched over. And they admit also that these cars, you know, they thought they were it was more of a perceived value, and they're very happy with their American cars. So I'm just kind of surprised at you, of all people, that you wouldn't be proud to say you're driving an American. Well, I understand, but still, it's, you know, I come from the era, and you may remember this because you're about my age, I think. But you, the era when Eat Your Toyota was, you know.
Oh, Bobby, my father worked in a tool and die shop all his life in Lansing, Michigan, making parts for General Motors, you know, for the automobile plant. My friends all, their dads all worked in making those cars in General Motors. I would suggest to you, Bobby, that if you look inside your American-made car, you're going to find that probably 50%, actually, if you go on a part-by-part basis, piece-by-piece basis, probably 70% of what's in it was not made in the United States. Radio was not made in the United States. We can just go, you know, right on through.
Nevertheless, it speaks the message by American.
Yeah.
And I think that's a message that you're trying to convey.
My point, Bobby, is that if we say that the way that we promote, say, for example, American goods, the way that we promote American goods is simply by buying American goods, then what we're saying is we're buying into the theory that you are voting with your dollars, and the people with the most dollars have the most votes, and that's not democracy. My suggestion is that we need to change the fundamental rules. As I said when I was talking with Bernie, the year that I bought a Honda Insight was the year that our government took our tax dollars and gave a $1 billion gift. It was a grant to Chrysler, which is not an American company, by the way, it's a German company now.
I know.
To Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors to develop hybrid technology, and it was for sale in the cities of America. So, you know, I think that there are some very real problems, and again, I pointed out, I think that it's our tax policy that's driving people to buy big cars. Now, some of them are made by American companies, obviously, and our trade policies, and we need to fix those. We need to be providing the incentive for these guys. I bought the Toyota Prius because it was the only hybrid car I could buy that I could fit in.
Well, it just disappoints me, coming from you, that you seem to be advertising Toyotas and Hondas and Land Cruisers.
Yeah, well, I'm not advertising them, but you know, I get your point. Yeah, thanks a lot, Bobby. Good to hear from you. I just, you know, what can I say? It's, well, I guess I've said it. Aaron in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Aaron, we got about a minute left. What's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. Hey, I just think that we have such a cynical system where people can do a lot of deficit spending and cut taxes for the rich, and the average taxpayer has no idea what's been done on their behalf.
Right.
Nobody ever gets a statement saying, for your family of four, we've incurred $5,000 to declare war on other countries and give tax cuts to the rich.
Yeah, it would be interesting if we got an annual statement from our government, the way that corporations issue annual statements to their shareholders about, you know, what's happening with the money.
Exactly.
I have a feeling it would cause a lot of change because so much of it, I mean, here a large chunk of our federal budget right now is going to the military, huge chunk. A large chunk is going to service on the debt, the national debt. You know, those two things, I believe, I used to have the chart in front of me. I believe those two things combined constitute a little over a third of the entire federal budget. It's an enormous amount of money. Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. We need to continue this conversation as time goes on. I just think this is really important that we consider having an industrial policy in the United States that's going to encourage companies in the United States to be manufacturing products that we consider important for our people, number one. And number two, that we'd be keeping our jobs in the United States. And, you know, Bobby's point is well taken. And It's we have to change the rules of the game if you're gonna see this thing extend right across the country. You can't just say, oh, I'm just gonna buy this and that's gonna solve the problem. It's not gonna solve the problem. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations all across the United States, on Sirius Satellite Radio, and various internet providers. What was good for our country, Paul Krugman writes today, in the New York Times, a former president of General Motors once declared was good for General Motors and vice versa. GM has laid off a whole mess of folks. And he makes the point that GM last year spent $1,500 per vehicle on health care. By contrast, Toyota spent $201 per vehicle in North America and $97 in Japan. He says if the United States had national health insurance, General Motors would be in much better shape than it is. So I just want to say, individual actions, yes, they have some consequence. Larger societal actions are going to be absolutely necessary to solve these kinds of problems. And in the context of larger societal actions, I mean, that's why we have elected representatives. That's why we have a government. Colleen Raleigh is with us. Colleen is actually standing up, speaking out, and running for Congress. Congratulations, Colleen. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
The website, Colleen Raleigh, ColleenRowley.com, if you want more information about this. Colleen, you were famous, notorious, whatever, infamous, depending on, I suppose, which side of the aisle somebody is on, for speaking out about something that you witnessed when you were at the FBI. For those of our listeners who may not be familiar with that or who may have missed it or who may have forgotten the details, can you give us a quick summary of what first brought you to prominence?
Well, I wrote a 12-and-a-half-page memo in May of 2002 when we were basically still stuck on this point of that nothing could have prevented 9/11. All public officials were pretty much echoing the same blanket defense. And when I wrote the 12-page memo, which was in the course of the Joint Intelligence Committee's inquiry, I tried to point out several ways that this was not true. And I think that it ultimately it was successful because it led to a long-term Inspector General investigation, as well as even in a way a little bit to the 9/11 Commission.
But by saying you just kind of casually toss out this is not true. I mean, really, this is a bombshell. I mean, what you're saying is that 9/11 could have been prevented.
Yeah, if you remember back, one of those public statements, of course, was Condi Rice. She said famously, I don't think anyone would have known that someone would fly a plane into a building. And, of course, Condi Rice, it's true, may have personally not known that, but, of course, there were many other people because, in fact, there had been prior attempts to fly planes into buildings.
Well, in fact, the president himself, just a few months before that, had been at a meeting in Europe. My recollection is it was a G8 meeting, where he had to go sleep on a destroyer, an aircraft carrier, or something off the coast of, as I recall, it was Greece or Italy, because there were credible reports that Al Qaeda was going to hijack a plane and fly it into the hotel that he was staying in.
Correct. There were just lots of things. The FAA had over 50 warnings. President Bush himself, now when I wrote my memo in May of 2002, I actually did not even know that the president had been briefed in early August of 2001. But see, we never get to those unravelings if you have a nice blanket defense that protects everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ancient history now because so much has happened since 9/11. So when you ask me what did I do, it's kind of, you have to really take people back and put them in the point of time 9 months after 9/11 when we still had not, the world really did not know about the presidential briefing. They didn't know that Ashcroft had told the FBI he didn't want to hear about terrorism. We didn't know that planes had been attempted to fly into the Eiffel Tower. All of these things that were blocked simply by a continued denial on the part of public officials.
So here we have Colleen Rowley, a woman who, as an 11-year-old girl, wanted to join the FBI. You wanted to join the FBI your whole life, if your bio is accurate, and something that you really cared passionately about. You'd worked your way up in the FBI, and you write this memo saying, hey, everybody is saying 9/11 couldn't have been prevented. We couldn't have anticipated it. In fact, not only could it have been prevented, but we had the information to prevent it.
Yep, it's of course there's a lot.
You had the information to prevent it.
Yeah, not me personally, but our agents were investigating, and if they had the proper backup, there's a lot of ifs here, and that's where, of course, people can easily hide behind all these things, because it's like a lot of things. There's a lot of endemic problems. There's a lot of individual mistakes. And all of these things would have had to change in order for 9/11 to be rectified. But there was a very easy way. There was a very easy way that 9/11 actually could have been prevented, which was the guy, the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, was George Tenet. And he actually knew most of these dots. And all he would have had to do was recognize he needed to bolt the cockpit doors.
Mm-hmm.
He needed to order the FAA, which was something already done in Israel. Their cockpit doors had been bolted for some time.
Right.
So when you make up all these excuses and all of these, well, if, there was a couple of easy ways. And, of course, if it had just occurred to the right person in authority, and, again, many people didn't know that George Tenet actually was. There was a lot of talk about there were so many dots that couldn't be connected.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, they had made their way up to George Tenet, and, in fact, he had connected a lot of them.
Well, and in fact, back in the 1970s, when we were having an epidemic of airplanes being hijacked in the United States to be flown down to Cuba, there was a proposal put before Congress to harden the cockpit doors of commercial airliners. And the commercial airline companies, the big airline companies, lobbied against it because it would have cost millions of dollars and got it defeated. So it's not like this had never been discussed in the United States. I mean, this is just like, you know, they were just like, you know, we're not going to spend the money on this. And so to save a few bucks, and that's probably, and that may be why the Bush administration was unwilling to raise the topic, because they knew that the industry was not, did not want this to, you know, wouldn't go along with hardening cockpit doors.
Yeah, and again,
speculation, but.
Yeah, people, it's very, afterwards, it's always easy to find excuses. And, of course, when you have a lot of people involved, as 9/11, it involved, you know, thousands of government employees, as well as actually the public in a way. The public was overly complacent, too. So you had all these people. Well, then it's even more easy to not want to unravel what happened, because
right.
it's going to be a painful thing to unravel that kind of a mistake.
Colleen Rowley, you are now running for the United States Congress in the 2nd District in Minnesota and the 2nd Congressional District. What caused you to decide to run for public office? It's a brutal environment out there politically these days.
Well, you're right. It is brutal, and it's at a considerable sacrifice right now in a lot of ways. But what motivated me was the series of mistakes that were made, not only before 9/11, of course, because those were already occurred, and I feel kind of actually partly to blame for some of that. What has motivated me is to watch all of the continuing mistakes and errors and overreactions that have caused us to even dig ourselves further into quagmire and not to try to do something about all of these problems in the world. You know, you could say, well, people didn't like, they hated us before 9/11. Well, that has it gotten better? You know,
yeah.
Look at right now. I think Americans are even more hated in the world than they were even before 9/11.
Oh, and the week of 9/11, really the world was with us. I mean, we had a golden opportunity. Colleen Rowley, have you aligned yourself with a political party?
I'm running as an independent-minded Democrat, and, of course, that's my own description there with the independent-minded part.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually the only Democratic challenger in our second district to John Klein, the Republican incumbent. And John Klein is a very far right-wing type. So I'm calling myself independent-minded because, of course, that fits with my background. I'm not the type to have people, you know, dictate my thoughts or my looks or anything like that.
Well, I think you're doing great. I love the always try, you know, kind of handwritten there on your website, the Colleen Rowley for U.S. Congress website, which is at Colleen Rowley, ColeenRowley.com for our listeners who may want to check out what you're doing and support what you're doing. I think it's just great and marvelous that you are running. I'm assuming that you are looking at a variety of issues beyond just 9/11.
That's correct. In fact, one of them, I just saw you on a public broadcast show on global warming last night, in fact.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't realize you were the same person, but obviously the energy crisis and rising gas prices all tie in with, of course, security, national security, and the
yes.
Iraq war.
Yeah, they do.
And it's a complete tie, and it's almost kind of hard to separate these issues out, but I think we need to become, we need to develop independence from oil, Mideast oil, obviously, for a lot of reasons. Well, one, of course, is the national security issues, but the other one is the fact that we have to stop releasing these hydrocarbons.
Yes, well said. Colleen Rowley for U.S. Congress. If you'd like to find out more about her candidacy or help her out, go to ColeenRowley.com. Colleen Rowley for the United States Congress from the 2nd Congressional District in Minnesota. Good luck.
Thank you.
Colleen, I wish you well, and thanks for being on our program today. Great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program. We're tuning in as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. The website, tomhartman.com. However you spell it will get you there. You can click live chat, drop you into the live chat room. It's the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. General madness in the stores. Reverend Billy is out there. The Church of Buy Nothing. He's saying, buy nothing, you know, give it up. And then, of course, Saturday declared in some states, here in Oregon, for example, the mayor of Portland, Tom Potter, declared it a buy local day. That's a good idea, good plan. 1-866-440-THOM, our website. Richard in Long Island City, New York. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
Thank you for putting me on your insightful radio show. Now, Tom, I received an email yesterday about a lawyer from Utah named Paul Young, who was hospitalized after being attacked by two men in suits.
Who looked like they were Samoans.
Yes.
That part, you know, when I read that, my Hunter S. Thompson bell went off. I'm assuming you've read Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
No?
Okay. Well, it's a great book, and you got to read it sometime. But in any case, you know, I'm familiar with the story you're talking about. This guy was the story suggests that this guy was participating in outing a major U.S. corporation in having some involvement in bribing U.S. Supreme Court justices to rule in favor of George W. Bush in the Bush v. Gore case.
Yes.
And frankly, I don't think anybody had to bribe them. I mean, the ones who voted for him, by and large, were appointed by either Reagan or Bush themselves. But in any case, you know, I don't know the beyond just that one story that's on conspiracyplanet.com, Richard, I don't know that there are any details beyond that, so I can't really comment on whether it's even real.
Yes, Tom?
Yeah.
It kind of rings a bell because I was convicted of threatening a federal judge in 1991, and they took me to trial in the same U.S. courthouse where the victim judge worked. And I raised the issue, and in the U.S. Court of Appeals, they signed a judgment order, just affirming the conviction without giving any reasons. And I think that these just judges are ethically challenged.
Yeah, well, I'm not disagreeing with you, Richard. And there's a bunch of them out there. Particularly when you consider more, and thank you very much for the call. You consider more than half of all the judges, all the federal judges sitting right now, have been appointed by George W. Bush. Just consider that for a minute. More than half. Why? Because during the last 3 years of the Clinton administration, as the Republicans took over Congress, they refused to hold hearings. They refused to allow these judges to have votes. They refused to allow to seat them. And, as Alex says, may Hunter rest in peace and Gonzo journalism live on. Amen, brother. And so anyhow, 1-866-440-THOM, our number. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Well, I hope you're having a great Thanksgiving weekend, Tom.
We are. And it's getting better. In fact, our youngest daughter just dropped by.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Yeah. I enjoy when my older son's here, too. Do you think that W. Cheney et al. Believe that America to them is like a financial statement, whereas all the wealth belongs to those who have so much because they deserve it since they've done everything right in their warped neocon mind? And I know I'm being reductive here, but my point is it seems that they can't reward the wealthy enough, and then therefore they can't punish the have-nots enough. But they kind of pat us on the head, and they give us political rights that are really nominal when the economic system is transferring more and more wealth to the already obscenely wealthy.
Yeah, as Franklin Roosevelt pointed out in January of 44.
And those wealthy, they control the political system vis-a-vis a two-party system that yields choices between Republicans and Republican lights who give us a privatized voting system.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying I want to give up my political rights. I cherish those. But they'd be more meaningful if we weren't headed for feudalism. And I think the objectivist neocon types don't really see America like we do in its fullness, including people. I think they see people who aren't wealthy and who aren't so-called producers as expense items on a spreadsheet or a set of skills.
Bonnie, corporate America is all about that. I mean, they're just right up front saying, you know, labor is an expense. It's part of an expense equation. We used to have an ethic in the United States that labor was something different than parts. You know,
exactly.
That you can negotiate for the cheapest parts, but you didn't negotiate for the cheapest labor because labor was all of us. It was society. And that ethic started disintegrating when Reagan came in and busted up PATCO and began the whole process of saying, no, sorry, labor is just another part. It's another expense item on the expense sheet. And I think that these guys, it's neo-Calvinism, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Calvin back, you know, 300-400 years ago said, basically, wealth is a sign of the blessing of God. And that if somebody was wealthy, that meant that God was blessing them, because, you know, God made all decisions, so therefore it must be. And if somebody was poor, that means that God is cursing them, and who are we to argue with God? It's a nice rationalization for those people who were either born wealthy, which is about 40% of the Fortune 400 wealthiest individuals, or those people who've, you know, done very well. And it's not serving America's interests well. You're so right, Bonnie. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. You're so right in saying that without economic rights, we're not free. I mean, a necessitous man is not a free man, to use Roosevelt's exact language. It's 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Pancho was a bandit boy. His horse was fast as polished steel. He wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel.
And welcome back.
Pancho met his match.
Oh, it's Pancho Villa. That's who the song's about. Yeah. For a minute there, I thought this is a very strange song. Our bumper music, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the weekend, right? I mean, it's TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, whatever's appropriate. But if for our listeners in Saudi Arabia, today is the day that you get to go to the public executions. Every Friday, the public executions in Saudi Arabia. An average of two a week. Two people a week. And typically, people only know that they're going to be executed when they come around and put handcuffs on them and take them out of their cell on a Friday. They're not, you know, given these sentences in public courts. This, our ally, Saudi Arabia. Now, you might think that that's kind of grim, but consider this. First of all, the European Commission now is saying that they want specific answers from Washington, D.C. on reports that the CIA is running secret detention centers in Europe where people might be tortured and even killed. This is from the Justice Commissioner, Franco Frattini. He's Italian, but he's the Justice Commissioner for the entire European Union. In Iran this week, two men are being executed for being gay. Pattern of persecution of gay men that stands in stark violation of the rights of life and privacy, Human Rights Watch said today. Iran, of course, the form of government, the Shia theocracy, that in all probability we're going to see in Iraq sometime in the next year as a result of Bush's brilliant plan to overthrow Saddam Hussein's secular government. Yes, he was a secular tyrant, but at least he was replace him with a religious tyrant. Right up Bush's alley. And this week, or next, one or the other, this week or next, we are going to see in the United States the 1,000th execution since Gary Gilmore in 1977 became the first person to executed after a 10-year moratorium. There was about 10 years there where the Supreme Court had ruled that the death sentence was unconstitutional, and then they made it legal again in 77. Gary Gilmore's last words, "Let's do it." Shot to death, firing squad, Utah, 1977. And since 1973, now keep in mind, we're about to execute our 1,000th person. Since 1973, of the people on death row, 122 of them have been set free, most of them in the past 5 to 15 years because of DNA evidence. More than 3,400 prisoners are currently on death row in the United States. In the past 28 years, the United States has executed one person every 10 days on average. So much for moral righteousness and indignation about Saudi Arabia, right? What kind of society do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a society that brutalizes, that uses brutality as an instrument of state power? It's just amazing to me that you have cons out there who say, we wouldn't want the UN running our government. We wouldn't want, we don't want them telling, and or the, you know, the their favorite thing, anti-government bureaucracy, right? You wouldn't want the same people who bring you the post office and the IRS and the, you know, or whatever the favorite, you know, government agency that they want to bash that week is to be making decisions about your health care, would you? Well, I would say, do you want a government bureaucracy similar to that runs the IRS and the post office or whoever you want to pick on? I frankly think both the IRS and the post office are actually fairly well run. But nonetheless, deciding who's going to live and die? I mean, executing people in the United States? So, you know, but cons don't much like it when you flip that around on them. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Pretty much anything you want to talk about today. Pat in Ann Arbor, Michigan on the line. Hey, Pat, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Happy Friday to you.
Well, thank you, and the same to you, Pat.
I read something in a World War II history book over the week, and I wanted to get your perspective on it because of your expertise on the subject and because I think it ties into Iraq. Part of a chapter was dedicated to the German technological breakthroughs and how they were completely wasted by Hitler at the end of the war because he refused to change his strategy. I mean, they developed rocket technology, and instead of using it for defense for anti-aircraft, he insisted on building these big rockets to attack London with, and how when they developed jet technology, his commanders wanted to build fighter planes to help protect them against the Allied aircraft, and he wanted to build bombers to attack London with again. And the book makes the theory that Hitler was his own worst enemy because he would not budge from an offensive strategy to a defensive strategy.
Yeah, there's a lot of Germans who wouldn't argue with that. And in fact, when I lived in Germany, I met a few who have, for better or for worse.
The other thing, too, about Hitler is once he made up his mind, nobody could tell him different. I mean, you could not approach him with intelligence.
He was considered to be infallible.
Yeah, I mean, but doesn't that tie into right now what's going on to Iraq? I mean, even though it's proven that our strategy of driving down the same roads and getting blown up by, explosive devices day after day is supposed to be working, Bush refuses to change the strategy.
Yeah, although I wouldn't say that Bush is Hitler because they both share that weird personality quirk of being so insecure that they're unwilling to have people within their staffs tell them that they're wrong. I do agree that in both cases it was a it's destructive to their nations.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. Have a great weekend.
Okay, thanks a lot, Pat. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-THOM. Jeffrey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Jeffrey. You are live and on the air? Jeffrey, you got to listen to your telephone, not the radio. We'll come back to you. Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. It's great to talk with you again.
Thank you for calling, Scott. What's up?
Well, I live in the south side of Chicago as a child, and we had a problem there. We had a lot of pollution, and it was very difficult to breathe the air for me, especially. I had asthma, and when some days I couldn't go outside. So my question is, Tom, I think it's really, really good to bring back industry to the United States, the manufacturing we've lost, especially that related directly to our defense. However, how do we handle the pollution that industry generates?
We have very, very sophisticated technology now, Scott, to pull out pollutants. I mean, it's possible to do manufacturing now in a virtually pollution-free way. From super, you know, less than a micron filters, ionization techniques that ionize particles and then slap them up against plates. I mean, we can put scrubbers on power plants that are just burning plain old flat out straight out coal and make them virtually particle free in terms of their emissions. It's just, you know, it's a matter of the cost to do it. And that's, you know, the debate, the Clinton administration, for example, with their mercury standards, the Bush administration coming along and saying, no, we don't. That's an undue burden on industry. It's going to cost them an extra $100 million a year, but we're going to give them $8 billion in subsidies. No, I think that it is possible. I know that it is possible for us to have a strong manufacturing base in the United States and not pollute our country. So, Scott, I think we should be bringing that industry back. I appreciate your call. Ed in Arlington, Washington. Hey, Ed.
Hey, Tom. First-time caller.
Well, thanks for calling.
I'll tell you what, I'm absolutely, absolutely thrilled that you guys are on the air.
Well, thank you.
And I just discovered you here about a month ago. So, anyhow, I've been listening to you every day. Every day I make sure I catch your show. And it seems like, to me, the biggest problem that we face in this country is a concerted effort to destroy public education.
I don't disagree with you. I think that's certainly one of the biggest. Yeah, because
it is the biggest, because for the last 30 years, we've been dumbing down America to the point where just one of your callers earlier today said he went and talked about, you know, President Kennedy, and the kids had no idea what he was talking about.
Right, and he was a teacher. Yeah, it's you know, I don't have the quote from Jefferson in front of me, so it's a bad paraphrase, but essentially he said, if you want to have a nation of people who are free and who are uneducated, you will have what never was and never will be.
Well, in reverse of that, Stalin said that in order to run a good dictatorship, you got to keep your people uneducated and uninformed.
Yeah.
And then you could do anything you want with them.
Yep. And I don't disagree with you at all, Ed. We desperately need better public education in the United States.
How do we go about getting it at this point where they've had 30 years of entrenchment?
Well, the problem is the they that you're talking about. And another fascinating study, I was talking with a friend of mine who's written a number of books on attention deficit disorder and these kind of stuff, and he's working on a book right now on exercise, and he said that, you know, back during the Kennedy administration, just phys ed classes that were in school, I remember hating that stuff in the 60s. You know, we had to go out for an hour and do phys ed. Turns out it helps kids learn. I mean, it dramatically improves their ability to learn.
Absolutely.
And so we need to have a national debate about education. And instead, what's happening has been, there's been a lot of national demagoguery about education. This whole no child left behind thing. It boils down to either people are arguing about, are we spending not enough or too much money, which is really not the issue, or, you know, you've got the conservatives trying to bust up the teachers union, Schwarzenegger at the head of the line there. And just the whole national issue. And what we really need to be talking about is, you know, as George Bush said, are our children learn? No, he said it so badly I can't even say it.
Is our children learning?
Is our children learning? Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Is our children learning?
Yeah, and we really need to be going back and saying, you know, there are some things that are just foundational to democracy. I mean, I guess I'm identifying myself here as an old fart, Ed, but you know, when I was in elementary school, we had to memorize, you know, the Bill of Rights. We had to memorize the preamble to the Constitution. We had to understand what all that stuff. And I'm talking about fourth, fifth, sixth grade.
Yeah.
I'm starting to remember.
We had social studies and government.
Yeah.
Two separate classes.
And then you had history on top of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Ed, thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah, keep up the good work, man.
You too, Ed. I mean, together we'll fix this country. Here's what has to happen, Ed. What has to happen is we have to wake up enough people in the country that the pressure starts building from the bottom up. So it happens at PTA and local school boards. And let's stop arguing about creationism and start talking about basic stuff. 46 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Old man, look at my life. 24 and there's so much more. Live alone in a paradise that makes me think of two.
Ed, welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least voting machines with open source software. It's where you know that your vote is actually counted. 1-866-440-THOM. By the way, this whole rant on education, I've written several books on education. And one of these days soon, I'm going to have to come back. We're going to have to revisit this topic at some length because Horace Mann did some horrible damage to this country back in the late 19th century. When he introduced the idea of education as an assembly line in the United States, he got it from the Prussians, now known as the Germans. And, well, it's a whole long story, and I don't have the time for it right now, but it's fascinating. And it leads right into why education has disintegrated in the United States. We'll talk about that as time goes on. Is it Leif in Seaside, Oregon? Am I pronouncing that right?
That's correct, Tom.
Hey, Leif.
Thanks
what's
a lot
up?
For essential program to this country's welfare. I have a question or a comment about the coming election. And in very general terms, I think the Republicans are destroying the country that at least I have known and regard highly. And yet, at the same time, I find that the Democrats have failed to play the role of the loyal opposition.
Yes.
In fact, at times I feel like I'm back in the McCarthy era. Is there a room for an independent party? I can't find myself being thrilled over either party.
Here's the problem, Leif. You know, at the local level, yes, there absolutely is. And there, over, I want to say 260, it might be 320. I don't remember the exact number, but several hundred local communities, you know, state, county, or cities, counties, around the United States, for example, in the last 5 years have adopted instant runoff voting as a result of the efforts of the Green Party. A lot of very progressive things have been put forward by the Green Party. And at the local level, I encourage people to participate with the Green Party, to join them, hang out, help out, whatever, because they are a source of pushing the Democratic Party back toward traditional American values on the one hand and of, you know, local change. The problem is, and this is the problem that James Madison was wrestling with. If you go back and read Federalist Number 10, it's a fascinating read. You can find it on the web. It's only 3-4 pages long. And basically, when these guys put together the Constitution, they were trying to figure out how do you deal with the problem of you want to have democracy, you want 50% or more. In other words, you want the majority to be making the rules, by and large. You know, there's certain things that you're going to set aside. That you're going to say, you know, even if the majority thinks we shouldn't have freedom of the press, we're going to hardwire that into the Constitution. But what do you do if you have political parties that emerge? Because if you have two political parties, then you could have, you know, 51% and 49%. You could have, you know, it's a small majority, but at least it's a majority. But if you have three political parties, then you could have somebody with 34% of the vote beat out two people who each have 33% of the vote, and now you've got somebody, you know, ruling or a party ruling the country with only a third of the part of the country behind them. And how do you deal with that? Because that's not democratic. And they didn't have an answer. And so Madison struggled with this, and he finally came up with the answer that he came up with, which is laid out in Federalist Number 10, was to beg people not to form political parties. That was the best they could do. It wasn't until 1861 that John Stuart Mill came along and said, hey, I've got an idea. How about if you have, say, for example, 100 seats in a legislature, in Parliament or in Congress, and if 30% of the vote goes to the Green Party, that they get 30% of the seats. They get 30 seats. If 6% of the vote goes to the Libertarian Party, they get 6 seats. If you know, 40% goes to the Democratic, they get 40 seats. And most other democracies around the world have adopted proportional representation, which is far more democratic than the first-past-the-post, winner-take-all system that we have. And so they are actually far more democratic than we are here in the United States. The United States, Greece, to some extent Canada and the UK, Australia, New Zealand are basically the only countries left in the world that don't have, you know, good, solid proportional representation. And New Zealand and Australia fixed that with instant runoff voting. And that's, again, what the Green Party is pushing in the United States. So, I'm sorry to give you a long answer here. You asked me what time it was, and I'm telling you how to build a clock. But I think that what we need to do are, number one, we need to be pushing for instant runoff voting, which is as close as we're going to get to proportional representation, because true proportional representation would require, you know, rewriting our Constitution, which would be a very dangerous thing to do. Number one, instant runoff voting. And number two, getting into the Democratic Party, infiltrating it, participating in the Democratic Party, and helping, you know, move them in a more progressive direction. And that's something that Americans have done a number of times. The Democratic Party's experienced several renaissances since it was created by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, back after they were begging us not to have party. Is that making sense to you, Leif?
Yes, it does. And the other comment that I was making was that there's an aura of fear that has been played upon, and it just takes me back to the McCarthy era.
Yeah.
And I find it intolerable.
I don't disagree with you at all, Leif. And fear is, you know, the worst way to govern people, and not what we want. KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ, we've got about a half a minute left. What's up?
Okay. Jesus said to the rich young man, give away all that you have and follow me. Everything I've read about Jesus is he's no fan of the rich. Where do the neocons, and by extension the Puritans, get this idea that riches were a sign of a blessing from God? And I'll get off and let you answer that.
Well, I don't have a good answer for you, KJ. I don't know. You know, as John Calvin come up with this idea that, you know, the logic, you know, was that if God controls everything and some people are rich and happy and other people are miserable and poor, it's kind of a variation on the karma theory that you find in Hinduism, that there must be some reason that people are rich and happy, and it must be that God loves them better than other people, or that they're more virtuous or something like that. And maybe it's just, you know, hey, stuff happens. I don't want to get into the esoterica of it, but that was the philosophical basis of Calvinism. Thanks so much to you for listening. Thanks to Dan and Alex in New York, to Louise and David for producing our program here, to our sponsors, to our affiliates. It's been a great week. Thanks to Shelby and Ben for streaming the program, the folks at AirAmericaRadio.com. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.